Hello and welcome to the Happy Hour. I'm your host, Tony Yang, and joining me today, as usual, are my fellow compatriots, Alex Cortez and Clark Price. How are you both doing?
Playing the Patriots and real Patriots.
Well, that is true. How about you, Clark? How are you doing?
Well, I'm still in a state of shock after watching the hearings today. And although as the saying goes, I'm shocked but not surprised.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean, everything that I heard is consistent with what I would expect, that a spoiled child would become such a spoiled, petulant, violent, and psychotic man. But I think I'm most impressed, and we can talk about this later on, about the heroism of this this woman who spoke, who worked in that office with him and others who served him. And she has more poise, more credibility, more character, more strength than all of those fools. All of them may be combined.
Right. Right. Well, I think we'll get to that, but I first want to talk a little bit about the state of the coronavirus, because as some things I've been watching, it's not good. You know, I know Pfizer, Moderna have recently released information on their new Omicron-based shot. This is for the BA1 variant, not the BA4 or 5 that we're anticipated to start to take over. There's yet to be a pan coronavirus vaccine. But BA5 in particular is a little bit scary because it shows about 3 to 4 times the evasiveness to the immune system of coronavirus compared to the previous versions. And I think there are some serious concerns about the pandemic fatigue and the United States being behind in terms of trying to develop a universal coronavirus vaccine, or one that meets the current variant. Again, this is very scary, I think, because we're about to lose all sorts of progress, particularly for this new variant that's out there. But as Alex can attest to, this is what coronaviruses do. They mutate and they have immune evasion. Remember, the common cold is a coronavirus, just a different type. And so, Alex, why don't you give us a little bit of briefing about what's going on in the background?
I think, as I've said before, and not just coronaviruses, but viruses in general, especially an RNA virus, in the replication process of the RNA genome, it's just more prone to errors. So, and in the process, those errors create mutations. You know, some of these mutations take in the form of more successful variants that you're seeing because of a variety of reasons or evading. And the thing is, the population itself is presenting a different environment for all these different viruses. Now there's a landscape where several folks are immune and to some strains, so that's why the other ones are intaking. You see these new variants. So it's a matter of selection, but it's still very, I think, important to try to take advantage of the current technology. And while we may not get a full penetration with the effectiveness of the latest vaccine, because this is kind of lagging behind these new viruses or new variants that are emerging, there's still a possibility that there's enough cross reactivity or that it's worth taking the shot. You know, So my recommendation for folks is, you know, still consider getting boosted when you get the opportunity. Ask for it if you are feel like you're at risk for a variety of reasons. But also just heed the, you know, non-pharmaceutical interventions, the masking, social distancing. And it is, that's getting harder. I mean, we've now been seeing this for almost 2 years where limited contact with folks, wearing masks. So the fatigue is certainly there, but these measures have proven to be effective in curbing contagion. So I say continue to mask and boost when necessary. But yeah, and we're going to keep seeing this, whether they're variants that are stemming from the same particular lineage or just something brand new.
Yeah, your thoughts, Clark?
I agree with everything Alex said. Although I mean, he says go ahead and get boosted. My question would be why the hell aren't you already boosted? Whoever you are who isn't boosted, because you should be. And if you're not, certainly do it. But why? And it's possibly because you have pandemic fatigue. And so I think that is, and by the way, what that means is that in any kind of a public crisis or even in private crises, there is a point where you're alarmed, you'll react, you'll pay attention, you'll take steps and measures. And then over time, you start to lose your sense of alarm, and what was very abnormal becomes the new normal. And you just sort of melt down into doing little or nothing. And that is just a public health phenomenon, but it also applies to things in the news. Like, for instance, the Ukraine war and the horrible atrocities committed by Russia on Ukraine I can sense it very palpably. They have taken a back seat. And I saw after the horrible Supreme Court decisions that we might want to talk about as well, that there was a big distraction from what was happening in Ukraine. And now today, competing with the atrocious and abominably bad Supreme Court that we have, is the abominably bad Donald Trump that helped create it. All of this produces fatigue. And I hope the point of these discussions that we have is to keep attention focused on important subjects.
Right. I think the coronavirus is a very important subject because it's not done with us yet. And there could be another wave this winter that's equally as bad as the Omicron wave. And if we're not careful, I know Americans are tired of it. If you poll Americans right now, as some of the articles have suggested that I've read, they are tired. I don't think we could get Americans to take a fourth shot, even though they need to take a fourth shot. I mean, it's really difficult to get an annual flu shot for most people anyway, right? I mean, we have a fairly low uptick rate, 50% at best.
I heard that I didn't independently confirm this, but that the infection rate was 10%. In terms of those tested, 10% are positive, which is pretty high.
That's only of the verified cases. It's probably actually even higher if we take a look at the availability of home testing and people kind of just testing at home at the moment. So there's those effects as well.
Good point.
And Alex, you may want to talk about this as well. One of the things that's kind of happened as well, as a result of the pandemic, the seasonality of these respiratory viruses, the chain has been broken a little bit because, you know, certainly my wife, who's a hospital chaplain, what they're noticing at the hospital is all these, you know, seasonal sort of respiratory colds, right? Like RSV, respiratory simplex virus, and those sort of things typically are in the winter time. You're prepared to see that. It's seasonal, but now it's been pushed back because of all the non-pharmaceutical interventions, right, Alex?
Right. And I think we did talk about this a few weeks ago, I believe. But it is for that very, very reason. I mean, we've shifted our behaviors. Not everyone. You know, there's still people that acting as if nothing's going on, but they don't live in a vacuum. So there is just less interaction. And I mean, you're seeing the after effects of reopening things, reopening schools, reopening places, the ever shifting. We mask, we don't mask. We'd suggested that you mask, kind of guidelines that exist for different places. So.
And I went to a work conference this last week, guys. This is just my anecdotal story, and I promise to move on so that we're not distracted about Ukraine. That should be our next topic. But this last week, I went to Utah for a conference. Mind you, it is a health conference that I was going to. And as I'm walking through the airport, no one is masked. No one is absolutely. Now they were masked on the California side, but definitely not on the Utah side. And the only person that I found masked at the airport in Salt Lake City was an Asian American physician traveling. So I mean, that's the only other person I saw that was masked. And so clearly, if that is a measure of the pandemic fatigue, we might not be in the best place in the world with a very highly infectious variant that's out there, and potentially not very good tools because our vaccine development is lagging behind the emergence of these new variants quite significantly. So, and so it's just a warning. I think it's good public information, and we have to make decisions based on that. At the same time, you know, we need to double down on research, even though it's waning, right? And that's something that we definitely need to do. But as much as we're fatigued by that, I think we're also fatigued by Ukraine. I think what would have drawn insane moral outrage were the Russians fired a missile and targeted a shopping mall.
With 1,000 people.
Yeah, with 1,000 people in it. Yeah, with a missile. I think would have been outraged in January, in February. Now it's just kind of like, well, this is what the Russians do. You know,
become normalized.
Yeah.
That's us.
Well, I hope that our strong support of Ukraine becomes normalized. And I just, as I've said before, we cannot allow Ukraine to lose this war. It would be a very bad message. I saw today that Turkey, which I believe I would describe as a little bit sus, is allowing Sweden and Finland to join NATO. So that's happening, and I'm sure to the enormous displeasure of Vladimir Putin, one of the world's most atrocious people, and a person I continue to suspect may have consulted with Donald Trump on his coup of American democracy. But and it was revealed, by the way, a couple of days ago that that film, that British film crew that was supposedly capturing Donald Trump's resolute triumph in being the worst traitor to the United States in its history, caught a moment, I guess, 8 days before January 6th, in which he had an odd phone call with Vladimir Putin.
Don't they have the audio of that?
He
was on tape
down by his boss.
I don't. Yeah, that's good. I don't think they have the audio. That certainly would be interesting to hear. But yeah, we have so many things to be concerned about. Well, we cannot let Ukraine fall. It would be a disaster. It's already a disaster, but it would be a strategic disaster.
Alex, what do you think? I mean, the interesting thing is the Russians have been able to continue selling oil. The Chinese in particular and Asian countries have been particularly willing to buy the oil. And they've been, you know, I think the prognostications of the Russian default happened 3 months later than we thought it would. And so,
yeah, I mean, we have to figure out, we have to crack that one and hit him where it hurts and just tank their economy.
Well, these ultra yachts that the oligarchs had and have now been confiscated, I think we could raise some money if we put on a worldwide pay-per-view where these yachts are all brought together in very deep ocean waters and then are rammed into each other at the highest speed of which they're capable of. And so that's what people are paying to see. Everybody loves a good mega yacht smash up. So to have about 12, 15 of them all colliding at once, and then we'd have GoPro cameras all over catching the exquisite crashing and crunching as they and then slowly sink.
Sell them and give the money to Ukraine.
Well, yeah, couldn't you sell them and then? Well, but who would buy them, right? I mean, the yacht is a very oligarch thing.
The problem is they might steal them back. I'd rather them just sink.
I mean, those luxury yachts are a very oligarchic thing, right? Like, it's a Bond villain that would own
a yacht. Yeah, it's only a super villain. Unless you could rebrand them as ships for lepers and other people with infectious diseases. And so they can live their lives in the lap of luxury.
Turn them into floating hospitals.
Yeah, that would be okay.
Yeah, but we already have one. You know, the Navy already has floating hospitals, Alex, and they're much better. That's part of the problem. But go ahead.
You take my point. It's a joke.
No,
but these oligarchic boats and the other trappings of Putin's regime are quite disgusting and offensive. So it all needs to be to go away. And now's a good time for that. But anyway, let's not dwell over much on this.
It's also important to note that President Biden is over in Europe trying to strengthen all the ties with responses to Ukraine and to try to build a coalition and an alliance and to continue the fight, even though just about every Western country is facing sort of some economic headwinds, both with the supply chain and with inflation that are ongoing. And so we shall see what happens. I think there is the potential for a lot of fatigue in Western democracies, but we have to keep in mind that's something that Vladimir Putin really is counting on and betting on. And so I encourage, you know, our listeners to kind of research the issue and to keep abreast of it, because the situation, particularly the military situation, is not looking good at the moment for the Ukrainians in eastern Ukraine.
Russia has the depth of manpower, resources, materiel, and they can just wage a war of attrition, and Ukraine is going to fall first.
Yeah.
So that's the problem.
Yeah, and I think that's something that we need to kind of keep an eye on moving forward. I forget who the who the Russian specialist that they are brought on front line, but I recall she had the best point of what's the end game here, and Putin will grind Ukraine into a fine ash before he lets them win. And I think that's kind of the scenario.
Right. And he doesn't care about the cost.
Yeah. I mean, his power is that absolute. So I think that's something we need to focus on as we're being distracted by domestic concerns. This last week, we had two rather landmark rulings. I'm going to start with the first one. I think we can kind of leave it because I think our discussion is I think we're all universal. We think it's a bad idea. But now apparently you can the Supreme Court has ruled that New York's law that requires you to have a license and a credible threat to carry a concealed weapon on your person is unconstitutional, that you have a right to conceal your weapon because you're afraid of any of and for personal protection as you go across the as you go about your business during the day. You need a gun because there's all that fear of society and everything that's going on. And I think it's really interesting because I think that's the typical Republican playbook. Let's ramp up your fear. And then let's give you a gun because that's such a wonderful solution to everything. And so that was the first ruling that came out that was highly controversial with that. So with that, Alex, what do you think? Do you need a gun everywhere you go in Riverside?
Apparently I do.
Do you want a gun in the lab?
Yeah, I mean,
you're an educator
for that one. I mean, it's just getting too ridiculous here. It's not necessary. They're overreaching with the interpretation of that law. I mean, yes. However you feel on the issue and whether or not you feel like you need to own a gun, I feel honestly safer without one. But because just look at the, if we're learning anything from the news cycle, when are the good guys using the guns?
Right. Only in Ukraine.
And it's supposed to, I mean, in the United States.
Yeah.
We're supposed to get it as a deterrent? Is it stopping anyone? I don't think so, but.
It's certainly not helping the crime rates in many of the major American cities. That's for sure. How about you, Clark? Well, what about this ruling?
Both of these rulings are, I would say, antisocial. I would say that they are willfully and deliberately misinterpretations of the history that underpins this ridiculous originalist philosophy that we need to seek out and understand what the founders thought when they wrote the Constitution by understanding the contemporary concerns that they have and applying them faithfully to the current era, and thereby maintaining fealty with the true intention of the Constitution. This means that it is not a living, but a thoroughly dead document. But the problem is it's actually living in the minds and the imaginations, the fears and the hatred of the people that have been cultivated to be on the Supreme Court over the last 40 years. There is a man that should be famous that isn't, named Leonard Leo. He is the founder and director of the Federalist Society, which is, by the way, is I think it was, they're running, they have a $20 million budget and sometimes run much more than that annually. And the way that you what the Federalist Society does is they cultivate young attorneys in often prestigious law schools, and what they're looking for is someone who doesn't have an open creative or investigative mind. They're looking for someone who is rigid in their thinking, particularly people who are deep, deep into religious inculcation and believe that man's law is subordinate to God's law. So once you do that and you accept this idea of no, of that, there really can be no separation of church and state, because God's law is over state law. Now, they're not supposed to say that, but they're not supposed to say a number of things that they really feel, because part of the, what the Federalist Society does is not only find true believers who aren't going to change their views, like John Paul Stevens or their number of justices who have grown in that appointment and have changed their positions on things, have started out as conservatives and then ended up being thought of as liberals. But they are doing, the Federalist Society does what it does to get these people in by hook or by crook. And they're regularly trained on what to do when you're asked, when you are asked about, what about Roe versus Wade. And we've seen them do the dance, and they all have done it. And what I mean by that is they've all lied. They've all lied to get the lifetime appointment, and then they steeringly and arrogantly behave like, yeah, what are you going to do about it? And this is one of the most arrogant decisions. These two decisions have been appalling, and I think we're going to get a lot more of them. This is not a conservative court. This is a radical court. And what they have done in both instances, in the New York gun ruling, which applies, it's going to have national implications, and also in the ruling on Roe versus Wade, is to take what they said was settled law when they were questioned by the Judiciary Committee, the Senate, take settled law and introduce chaos into it.
Let me before we transition to Dobbs versus Jackson, which is the case, it's also overturning Roe v. Wade. Before we get there, I don't want to leave the gun control ruling, because there was one particular element of that ruling that I thought, as a historian and as a constitutional scholar, that was really terrible. And that is Clarence Thomas. This is a man who I personally think is completely lost, and doesn't realize
totally unfit, totally unfit to be in a position.
His wife is into conspiracy theories. We know that much. Jeannie Thomas.
They both are.
Right. But he, in his decision on the gun control bill, and sort of saying that everybody, you know, the Constitution and the framers thought everybody could have a weapon on them, he read into the Constitution that right for individuals, forget the for a well-regulated militia part that was tacked on to the amendment. But do you know what case he cited? Do you guys know what case he cited as part of his justification for overturning 109 years of settled law in the state of New York?
No, in my
go ahead.
He used Dred Scott. Used the case that said African Americans have no place in the U.S. Constitution. That was in 1850. That was to justify the Fugitive Slave Act, making a Northern abolitionist, someone who is morally opposed to slavery, have to enforce slave laws. That is, like, if you see a African American person and someone said he's a slave and you need to return him to me, you were committing a crime if you did not enforce this person's property right. And they said, you need to go back. We need to capture you, enslave you, and send you back to Dixie, right?
For anyone that hasn't watched the series Boondocks, look up Uncle Ruckus, and that's my comment on
Right.
It's Thomas.
Yes. Yeah. Played by Roy Woods Jr. By Roy Wood Jr., by the way. Comedian Roy Wood Jr. and his Uncle Ruckus. But I do want to say that one should never, if you're a student, never cite Dred Scott as a justification for anything. That is one of the most worst decided cases.
It's universally said to be the worst.
Yes. And I want to be very clear about that. This court will throw out all sorts of precedents and use that as justification. I wouldn't be surprised if they, in fact, use Dred Scott as justification for criminalizing abortion. Right? Because,
correct me if I'm wrong, isn't the Supreme Court going back to these obscure laws from, a couple centuries back now?
I think the process is that they decide what they want to do, and then they make up a way to get there.
Right.
I want to say
this. Dred Scott was not actually undone by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court made that ruling in 1850, and that touched off the firestorm of the Civil War. It took the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the Constitution to end slavery and also guarantee equal protection of federal laws. And so what they are doing now is really reinterpreting what that 14th Amendment means and what equality under the law means. They're really messing around with the fundamental nature of what it means to be a citizen and what rights are guaranteed by the Constitution. And that gets us into the abortion cases in Dobbs versus Jackson, right? The overturning of Roe v. Wade. They fundamentally have read into the Constitution, and I don't think people have been belaboring this point enough. But essentially what they're arguing is the fetus has rights because of the special nature of the fetus, right? If you read the decision, the ability of that to potentially be human life, right, trumps any sort of can trump a woman's unfettered right to choose to terminate her pregnancy.
Well, it is conceivable, and I think technically possible at some point, if not now, that every cell of the human body, including every cell in the male human body, could potentially be cloned into a human being. So it is
theoretically, yes, you can.
Yeah. And so what that means is that there is potential new human beings throughout the human body, and to limit it just to the female body because that's the traditional biological way in which you can reproduce is going to become technically outdated.
Well,
go ahead.
Can I say that? Because you just brought up a really good point. By that, given the virtue that everybody has living stem cells in their bodies, they should outlaw the death penalty. Just with that alone, because that stem cell could be a human. So,
Alex, why are you asking people to be ethically consistent?
I'm not. I'm just kind of devil's advocate. But, does this mean that we're going to have to start claiming pregnancy, a fetus as a dependent in our taxes, and what does that mean for
they opened a can of worms.
Parental,
well, there used to be, these rights used to be under Roe conferred upon some kind of viability, and in the old medical literature, there was this notion of quickening when that collection of the fertilized cell would move, or collection of cells would move from the uterus into the womb, and that quickening was the arbitrary choice of the potential human. But now you have I guess it's upon fertilization,
Right. But you they're putting so many women at risk. I mean, not all pregnancies go.
I know. And that's the arrogant part. The cruel part is to force a woman to bear her father's child, product of incest or a rape. And what this means is that they have created a law that no honest or ethical human being can in any kind of good conscience follow, because that is an abomination to force a person to bear a woman to bear a child that is a product. And then also, I know that in the case of my own mother, my mother became pregnant, and had that pregnancy gone to term, she would have died. And so an abortion was performed on my mother. Do I think my mother's life was much more important than those collection of cells in her womb? Obviously. I think that the Supreme Court has gone insane. And yeah, they are absolutely not connected to the way people live. And as I said earlier, to take a settled law and a settled situation and introduce all of this chaos and the consequences, the cruel and life-changing consequences for a lot of people, yeah, for a huge portion of the population that is right, of childbearing age. Is this court legitimate? Absolutely not.
Well, and absolutely not. I will go further than that, and I'll add another word, which is unjust, and unjust.
An unjust court, exactly.
Right, because the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church of the United States, Bishop Michael Curry, issued an announcement saying that as a pastor who's worked in inner city parishes as a member of the Episcopal Church. Now, Episcopalians are extremely liberal, mind you, and they have always said that the moral choice needs to reside with the woman. She gets to make the choice. But Bishop Curry was quick to point out about the double standards that are going to result of this. There are going to be a certain segment of women that are still going to have access to these services. And then there are women who are probably black and brown, who will not have access to these services, who have to travel exorbitant miles to do this, right? And this is very problematic. And before we go too far into this, I want to give some context. Most Americans, according to a Life Science article published by Laura Gagel, most Americans believe that miscarriages are very rare. 5% of pregnancies are or less result in miscarriages. Well, that's not the case, because if you read in The Lancet as of 2021, miscarriages do matter. Approximately 15 to 20% of all pregnancies end in miscarriage. That's 1 out of 5. Mm-hmm. How much resource are you going to put in to investigate the 1 out of 5 pregnancies? That's about 20 million pregnancies in the United States, about 20 to 23 million pregnancies that end in miscarriage in the United States. So you're going to tell me, Greg Abbott, you're going to go ahead and investigate all these miscarriages that happen? I'll tell you what's going to happen. You know what? Who won't get investigated because of the disparities of justice in our country? Versus who is going to get investigated for having a miscarriage? Huh. Right? Think about that.
Think about who profits from jails and prisons.
Exactly. I mean, this is going to criminalize miscarry. Right? There's going to be a presumption. There needs to be an investigation because you had a miscarriage. That's exactly the thing that you need when you miscarry.
That's what happens when you get these ignorant fools in there with no science background, or just don't believe in science.
Or they do. Well, the, I mean, the you could be Rand Paul.
The Federalist Society has as I said, they'll look for people who are inflexible in their minds. They're unimaginative, they're rigid, and often they have an attitude towards religion which subordinates man's law to what they interpret to be God's law. So this is a kind of a Sharia law imposed by six Catholics, fundamentalist, rigid Catholics, engineered onto the Supreme Court. Does that represent the American people? I don't think so.
Catholic myself, I say no.
Yeah, because it doesn't even represent the Catholic Church. It's a brand of the Catholic Church. And by the way, here's something else that people might look into besides the Federalist Society. Look into a little known organization of Catholic extremists called Opus Dei, O-P-U-S, second word, Dei, D-E-I. They're involved too.
Well, I mean, all you have to do is look at the U.S. Conference of Bishops, you know, which isn't helping the matter.
I mean, but just to throw something out there, I mean, don't you find the coincidence in the timing of all these rulings with on the heels of the January 6th investigations oddly coincidental?
I certainly.
This is a distraction. They're desperate. They know they're cornered. They're trying to change as much as they can, and all those promises that were made back when Mr. Orange went into office.
Well, did you see that they just had? Yeah, I've certainly thought this, and they just had a another rally celebrating as Mr. President. Thank you so much. Now you've done so much for white America.
They don't even hype it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, and then they said later, oh, they misspoke. Really? It's completely consistent they misspoke the truth. That's exactly how they think.
They misspoke, but now they can carry their guns around. So,
yeah.
There are more guns than people in this country. There are more guns than people in this country.
But you know what? Honestly, we just need to call their bluff and not just sit idly and not just, what's the response? Let's call for donations for a campaign. I mean, yes, that's important, but actually start doing something while you can.
Well, that is my criticism of the Democratic Party. It's also been my criticism of my generation, the millennial generations left. Because it has been unable to have a sustained movement and issue as much as the right has had. You know, some of that's the nature of the left.
The rules. They're not good faith actors.
Possibly. It may be something just inherent to the left, I think. But it's been very problematic, I think, to have in an organized way the same thing as the right to life movement, just so consistent with that. And maybe
opportunist is always going to prey on the optimist optimism and hope.
It probably is. And I think you're onto something with that, Alex. I think.
And guess who they put in charge? A con artist.
Well, no, I mean, I think your thing is your particular statement and observation is very accurate. I think, you know, this is the first time in millennials' lives, certainly for that matter, certainly a lot of Gen Xers' lives as well, that rights have been taken away. And what does that mean? You know, I've always said as a historian, you have rights until they decide you don't have rights. There have been plenty of moments in history where people groups and, not just in the United States, but elsewhere, where they all of a sudden they start restricting people's rights. It's not one straight line of progress. And I think we're learning that, but it also requires sustained efforts both to protect democracy and democratic institutions and to protect civil liberties, all of which are under attack right now. I cannot remember a moment where all avenues of the American government are as discredited as they are at the moment. And I think this is the genius of Vladimir Putin. Am I wrong, Clark, in assuming that?
Because if you read the Mueller report, even though it's sadly redacted and should be unredacted, it was very much mischaracterized by Bill Barr. Russia, 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 and more Russia involved in influencing our elections and trying to spread division and chaos and fear and anger throughout American society. And the purpose of it is to diminish America and thereby strengthen Russia's position. It's a way of conducting war without firing a shot and having the United States be brought down. You know, Putin himself practiced judo, which is to use your own weight, your own body against you. And I think that's what he's doing with this, what this is called in Russia is active measures. So you're taking measures to influence people's thinking in the United States, and with that thinking, cause the country to spin apart. So I think that this has not been a coincidence. It has been intentional, and it has succeeded actually wildly. And I think it has almost taken down the United States, which certainly would have improved Russia's situation. And I suspect they would have participated directly and been a working partner with Donald Trump had he succeeded in his what was clearly an attempt to use violence to overthrow the American government and its processes of orderly change via democratic elections. And by ending that, you'd have Vladimir Putin, as the Amanaz Grease, the gray eminence behind Donald Trump, probably for the rest of Trump's life, which could have gone on possibly 15 years. And then it would have been a dynastic flow through the other, the unworthy and completely vile Trump family.
Well, I mean, the Trump family, I think, is highly liable after today's hearings. Today, of course, was when Cassidy Hutchinson testified before the January 6th committee, giving us all sorts of inflammatory evidence. I mean, of course, as all three of us have said, it's not a shock to us that President Trump was doing what he did. You know, he tried to take the wheel of the Secret Service vehicle to go lead the protesters into the Capitol building.
By the way, that's a secondhand account. Most of what Cassidy said was her actual witness. That part of it wasn't. So I'm not absolutely certain about that until I hear direct testimony on that. But the people that she got it from were Trump loyalists who you would not expect to say things about him that were unflattering. So that the fact that they did and that she's repeating it, I think, is significant.
Right.
But as I said at the top of the show, I think that she showed more dignity, more patriotism, more strength, more character than the rest of Trump's disgusting group of sycophants combined. They all should be, and this will sound very harsh, but I think that anyone commits treason against the United States should be hanged. So this is a case where the death penalty penalty should be seriously considered. But she is a hero and a patriot. And I note once again that almost all of the bad people here, I guess all of them are, in my view, probably the ones that I consider the bad actors, they're all Republicans. But then so are the good guys and the rare heroes. The two members of the committee who are Republican, Kinzinger and Cheney, I've been very, very, very impressed by them, because it isn't so unusual for a Democrat to say these things. It's not considered courageous because it's normal. But for a Republican, with the retribution and vengeance and the mafia kind of retribution that Trump would beat out there, it's incredibly courageous. I'm going to tell you something, and he's going to win.
Right.
Janie's going to win.
I think she will win in Wyoming. She's asking for crossover Democrats to vote. I also want to point out something else, and Alex maybe get some insight on this, but particularly for Cassidy Hutchinson, it's always remarkable to me, Alex, when a young person has to do this, right? Cassidy Hutchinson is actually only 25. And it's sometimes it always falls on a young person, and this is through some of my own experience, but a young person to tell truth to power. Well, and that is a very difficult thing to do.
I would also credit her parents,
yep,
and her teacher.
Yeah.
Who helped develop this incredibly fine person.
This is a person who has principles. And I think those things are really important. And to have principles at 25, I think that is something very, very difficult. And
well, a lot of people have died for this country.
Yeah.
They were very conscious of the principles they were dying for at that age and younger.
Yeah. Alex?
I was going to say, I think, and it's probably true for both sides of the aisle. I mean, I think we're missing the point in sort of representing these younger folks. That's why you see them act this way, and because they're disenfranchised, they're not being represented. When you have elected officials that are, you know, four or five times their age.
She showed more courage than speaker wannabe McCarthy on this particular issue.
McCarthy has less spine than a chocolate eclair.
Exactly. And so I'll leave it there. I'm sure there will be more to follow, but we have a few minutes left. So we will go with our one good thing. My one good thing this week is, and it doesn't get enough press, it's the 50th anniversary of of Title IX as well. I know this year was also the 50th anniversary of the Pell Grant, but the university has done a ton around Double the Pell. But I do want to give a shout out to Title IX, and in particular to all my sporty women friends who have benefited from Title IX. It's particularly a program that I think has benefited thousands of and millions of women. In particularly in the millennial age bracket, I specifically want to call that out, but the impact of Title IX cannot be understated, I think, both in higher education and in the workplace. So shout out to that. I think it's a great thing to have that and to have equal funding for participation. So that's my one good thing. Great. Alex, Clark.
My good thing is I just coming off my 2 week break leave, which was much needed, so I am feeling a little recharged. So I think it's what I'll share as my one good thing, because the news cycle has been anything but good.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one, Clark. Your one good thing.
I'm very glad to have some of the news media that we have in this country today. If we did not have MSNBC and CNN in doing what they've been doing, very good coverage. I'm just very glad that they're there and that they're carrying. Of course, there are a lot of outlets are carrying the January 6th committee, but the best thing is the January 6th committee. It's absolutely some of the greatest governance I have ever seen, and I'm very pleased.
Well, with that, I think that's a good place to end our show. I want to thank you for listening. And for Alex Cortez and Clark Prize, thank you for listening and tune in next time for more of the Happy Hour. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Bye.